Today's episode is sponsored in part by Modern Mammals, creators of a new hair washing product for men. You can help support Based on a True Story when you use the code BOATSPODCAST at modernmammals.com for 10% off. I've really been enjoying their shampoo light bar as an alternative to traditional shampoo. And I know it's in the name, but honestly, when I first used it, I was surprised at just how light and airy it feels. It reminds me of using a bar of soap for your hair, except it's even better than that because if you're like me, you don't like the residue that some actual bars of soap leave behind. And the shampoo light bar is easy to wash out without leaving any residue behind. Modern Mammals also focuses on creating products that help you keep your hair's natural oils so it's not left feeling poofy and frizzy. Go to modernmammals.com and use code BOATSPODCAST for 10% off. Again, that's modernmammals.com for 10% off with promo code BOATSPODCAST. Don't forget to use the promo code BOATSPODCAST so they know I sent you. Thanks, Modern Mammals. Okay, let's start today's episode. Hello and welcome to Based on a True Story, the podcast that compares your favorite Hollywood movies with history. Today, we're going to be looking at the 2017 movie from director Christopher Nolan, Dunkirk. To help us separate fact from fiction, we'll be chatting with the historical consultant on the film and author of Dunkirk, the history behind the major motion picture, Joshua Levine. Before we chat with Joshua, it's time to set up our game, Two Truths and a Lie. If you're new to the show, here's how it works. I'm about to say three things. Two of them are true, and that means one of them, it's an all-out lie. Are you ready? Okay, here they are. Number one, the senior most surviving officer from the Titanic helped in the Dunkirk evacuation. Number two, Churchill didn't expect anyone to evacuate from Dunkirk. Number three, people not in the Navy who took their boats signed a form to become temporary members of the Royal Navy. Got them? Okay, now as you're listening to our story today, your challenge is to find the two facts scattered somewhere throughout the episode. Maybe it'll be obvious. Maybe not. Can you find out which one is a lie? We'll do a recap at the end of the episode to see how well you did. All right, now it's time to chat with Joshua Levine about the historical accuracy of Dunkirk. Everyone knows movies are entertainment, so we all know that they're not supposed to be entirely accurate, and yet a lot of people still use movies as a source for their historical knowledge. So before we chat about some of these specific plot points, if you took a step back and gave the movie overall a letter grade on accuracy of the miracle at Dunkirk, what would it get?
It's a very hard one for me to answer this because you're asking me to grade my own work. And obviously not. Because it's not my movie, and I could advise, but obviously the director, Christopher Nolan, made the film he wanted to make and was, you know, made every single choice. But on the other hand, clearly I am implicated in this in some way. But I have to say I was very pleased with, you know, I was there when it was filmed and, you know, I was there for most of the way. And I was very pleased with how it came out and how it looked. And I would give it an optimistic B+, I think. I think he was very, you know, he took a lot of care with the things that really mattered to him. And there were things that were wrong. Often, funnily enough, not the things that people, you know, obviously the film gained a lot of attention and interest, and people were very, with a lot of articles and, you know, this is right, this is wrong. Historical accuracy, and often those articles were wrong, you know, pointed out that were not mistakes. And then there were things that nobody seen, or that I, there were mistakes that nobody seemed to spot. So, for example, I mean, there was the train carriage at the end was a good old 1970s British train carriage, you know, but I didn't see anyone spot that. So I think I'm revealing that. And then, you know, there were some things that were a matter of choice and sort of, so for, you know, the one thing that was, I found really interesting, the director was keen to find out about for example, women at Dunkirk, and there were a lot of women on the hospital ships, you know, nurses, and there were stewardesses on some of the passenger ships that came across. I didn't find any women on the little ships. You know, I think he would have liked there to have been a woman on the little ship. I didn't find that. So I gave, you know, funnily enough, there was an article in the Times, London Times, on, I think it was the 6th of June, 1940, talking about there having been a woman who took a boat across to Dunkirk. And the article said that she had phoned up the Admiralty. This woman phoned up the Admiralty asking to take a ship across, or take her own boat across. And she'd done it in a false voice. She deepened her voice. Said, well, I got to take a boat across. And the Admiralty had said yes, and she'd done it. These were the sorts of stories that were flying around, sort of rumors that were flying around in the days and weeks after Dunkirk, in days and weeks after any kind of a event like that, I suppose. And so I showed him the article and said to him, I suspect this probably isn't true. It's a sort of story that's flying around. But, you know, I gave it to him to, you know, do what you will with it. Then there were also, you know, I was looking for black soldiers, and this was a point before Commonwealth troops involved. So I found two mixed race soldiers, one who was killed before Dunkirk, one who was taken prisoner afterwards. And I told him, you know, that that's the information that I gave him. And then there was the matter of the quite interesting matter, I suppose, of the Indian. There were four Indian companies, animal transport companies in France. But of those four, only one was actually at Dunkirk. One company, which was comprised of, I think, three officers and 298 men, the 25th Animal Transport Company, actually made it off the mole, big non-jetty, on, I think, with the night of the 28th, 29th of May, but sort of, you know, early in the morning of the 29th. And so there were Indian soldiers at Dunkirk on the beaches, you know, or making their way to the mole. And again, I told him that. So, you know, and then there was a lot of criticism afterwards that Indian soldiers had not been portrayed in the film. You know, that's a whole debate to be had. And that's a debate about where we are in terms of filmmaking culture and you know, what should be shown in relation to what can be shown. But again, that, you know, that's the information I gave. So there was, you know, some things are, you know, factually right, factually wrong. The naval men on the mole should have been wearing helmets. They would have been wearing helmets. He didn't want to show them a helmet. There was also the point about the town of Dunkirk, which you only saw briefly, but not being beaten up enough, which I think is true. But then, you know, the director doesn't particularly like to use, or doesn't at all like to use CGI. And he wasn't going to bomb the actual town. And then the numbers of soldiers on the beaches, which, I mean, you know, I think a lot of people said beaches weren't messy enough. They weren't crowded enough. And again, there's some truth to that. But you've got to be careful with this because, I mean, you can look at this two ways. I mean, first of all, in fact, he did, you know, he, again, doesn't use CGI, but he did use 1,000 local people, local, you know, young people dressed in uniforms. And he, you know, used them actually a lot on the beaches. So, you know, he made them as crowded as conceivably he could, I think. But then the other point is they weren't always crowded. And we tend to think of, you know, there's this idea of the evacuation as being a certain thing. The story is one certain thing. And the truth is that like all history, like all stories, like everything that's happened in the past, there is not one story. And if you look at the accounts of different, you know, as I've looked over the years at many, many accounts and talked to many, many veterans, yes, there were points when the beaches were absolutely cluttered and crowded and there were queues and the queues disappear when the dive bombers came over and then reappear. But there were also periods, and bear in mind also, you've got 10 miles of beaches. You've got this evacuation happening for days and days and days. You've got hundreds of thousands of people coming and going. So there is no one story. The whole world was on the beaches. And there were periods when there weren't many people at particular places. And in fact, they were empty, particular places at different times, different. And there were times when the sun was shining and people were having a great time. There was a man telling me about a circus performer who was on, found a horse and on the back of a horse and performing tricks. And men were all lying in the sunshine, clapping and cheering as this man, you know, performed on a horse, which is not our picture of what Dunkirk was actually like. And, you know, there were times, and another man told me, you know, I had horror stories of people coming on the beaches after days of evacuation, terrible physical states and hungry and hadn't eaten for days. And one man who sort of sunk to his knees and took his helmet off and started to try and eat the leather strap on his helmet because his imagination couldn't go anywhere. He was so hungry and he didn't know what he could, you know, his mind just focused in on the first thing it focused in on. And another story of some of you watching a group of men all sitting around in a circle or miming eating with an imaginary knife and fork and just, you know, they couldn't get any food, but this was the closest they could come. And they were all sort of engaged in this sort of shared pantomime that was deadly serious. But on the other hand, I got the story of these three Royal Engineers who came off, you know, off the retreat and came onto the beach and found there were no boats coming in. So they went back out. I don't think beyond the perimeter. I think within the perimeter, but they found an establishment, like a bar, cafe, open. And this is during the evacuation. They said not only was it open, they were able to buy a bottle of champagne, which they drank. These were ordinary Englishmen, you know, wouldn't have touched champagne before in their lives. And they drank it and they decided they loved it. They could have more of their lives with them. Finished it, went back onto the beach. A boat came in, took them off, took them up to something bigger offshore and home they went. Again, not the typical Dunkirk story. But my point is simply that there was no one story. And there never is. And we're making a mistake to think that there is only one story. And so it was, you know, there was good behavior. There was bad behavior. There were people standing in orderly lines in queues. And then there were also people jumping queues. And a couple of accounts of people being shot when they tried to jump the queue to get on little boats. And so, you know, there was everything going. There's a man who found an ambulance and just got in it and stayed for days inside in his own little bubble, in, you know, at the top of the beach inside this ambulance and sort of tried to shut the rest of the world out and pretend nothing else was happening. So there's no one story and equally, there's no one picture of the beach that is correct. So that's an incredibly long way of saying I give it a B+.
I mean, movies are entertainment, right? And as filmmakers, you have to choose which stories you're going to focus on. And so it makes sense that, I mean, yeah, there's no one story, you're going to have to choose. And no matter what you choose, there are going to be some people that aren't going to like what you didn't pick or, you know, in that way, what stories you didn't tell. I mean, because you can't tell everything. They only have so much time.
You talk to veterans. It's always very interesting talking to veterans because they will have had their experience. And very often they are not willing to accept the experience of another veteran who had a different experience. You know, you're never rude to, you know, I would never sort of contradict a veteran, but you had to be aware that somebody who had lived through something to them, that was the truth of the matter. That was the reality of the matter. And if you put somebody else's reality to them, they would sometimes just say, except that didn't happen. And that, you know, we're all like that. I mean, we all, you know, you go into a court and watch a case over a traffic accident and, you know, you say what you saw and that won't be the same as what the person 30 feet away saw. It's just, that's how it is. And so, you know, it's actually quite fascinating when you do speak to, you know, large numbers of people and try and get a sense of what it was from so many different accounts. And it becomes something far more interesting and far less cliched, really, than, you know, what it might otherwise have turned into over time.
At the beginning of the movie, there is some text that explains the British and French armies have been driven to the sea that kind of sets up them being trapped at Dunkirk, kind of hoping for the miracle. But other than the text, the movie just kind of throws us into that story, which Makes sense. I mean, it's about that story. But can you expand a little bit more on the historical side to kind of set that up? You know, why were the British and the French armies surrounded by the Germans at Dunkirk?
Just before I do, it might be interesting. I happen to have a book from a talk I once gave. I don't want to speak for the director, but he didn't want to use too much dialogue. And so one thing that I think he found useful, I told him about the leaflets that the Germans dropped, and all sides dropped propaganda leaflets, but the Germans dropped these. These are copies of the real leaflet, and it's not to scale. I mean, it's much bigger than the actual leaflet. But this is what he put in at the beginning. Except he didn't put in the actual. I mean, you can see, let's say, British soldiers, look at this map. It gives your true situation. Your troops are entirely surrounded. Stop fighting. Put down your arms.
Real quick, let me mention, if you're listening to this and you want to see what Joshua is holding up to the camera, you can see that in the video version of this chat over at youtube.com/basedonatruestorypodcast.
And what he turned into for the purpose of the right at the top of the film was this, which you can see. I mean, it filmically, it's great because it cuts out the need for a lot of clunky dialogue about where are we? We're here. Why are we? We surround you. And actually, in reality, when I spoke to veterans, I mean, they said that, this thing was useful for, and again, he put this in, for two reasons. One, they didn't have toilet paper. But two, also, they didn't have maps. And the Germans dropped them a map. And it was really, this is great. Thanks. I mean, that kind of preempts the story. But basically, the British Expeditionary Force had arrived in France right at the beginning of the war, within days of the beginning of the war. You had all of these young men whose fathers and uncles and relatives and older men they knew had been out there just a generation previously to these same places. So it was a kind of, here we go again. And they came to France. They didn't move into Belgium. Belgium was, even though the attack was expected to come, the Germans were expected to attack through Belgium, they were expected to come into Belgium. But the Belgians didn't want the Allies to set foot in Belgium because they didn't want to provoke the Germans into attacking, even though they expected the Germans would attack anyway. They didn't want to actually, lay out the carpet for them by provoking them. So the British Expeditionary Force remained in France. And then for months, what was known as, the Americanism was the phony war. But I think the British knew it more BORE, as in there was nothing happening. But actually, they were quite, a lot of, if you think about it, these are young British men who'd never been abroad before, very, very few of them been abroad before. And they'd been brought up during the Depression, and the army gave them regular meals and income, and now adventure. And they were actually going abroad to see how other people, what abroad was like. And they stay, in fact, to show that they enjoyed. I mean, I found there was a battalion of the Middlesex Regiment that was started misbehaving and was told that this was in November, December of 1940, and told if you don't start behaving, we're sending you back to England. And they started behaving. They wanted to stay. And so the idea was that the expectation was there would be a German attack through Belgium. The British and the French would move up to meet the Germans in Belgium, and there would be kind of a repeat of the First World War, a war sort of mud and trenches and not a great deal of movement. And the French also had this large, something called the Maginot Line, which was a series of fortifications, really heavily defended fortifications along the border with Germany. And the French cry was, "Ils ne passeront pas," they will not pass, because they believed it was completely impregnable, it wouldn't come through. And what the Germans did, which was very audacious, and Hitler basically signed off on this, and maybe, you could argue that part of his hubris was a result of the success of this, why he never again doubted himself, was that they they did indeed attack into Belgium, and the British came forward to meet them on the River Deal, and two sides met. But at the same time, that was only a feint, really, by the Germans. A real attack was coming through the Ardennes, which is a hilly area, a heavily forested area, an area that, in theory, was impassable to tanks. So the Germans didn't try and get past the Maginot Line. The only pass on bar, they didn't pass. They didn't try. They came instead through the Ardennes, and it wasn't defended properly by the French. And the Germans just amazingly sort of shot through. And by the 20th of May, German tanks had reached the French coast. And so almost surrounded, completely surrounded the British Expeditionary Corps, which found itself then retreating. And so the retreat started sort of piecemeal. So from one river line, you know, from Deal to the River Esco, and fighting on all these, you know, heavy fighting on all these lines. And then as the retreat went further back, the British were setting up defended areas. So first of all, along the corridor, so defending canals and defending defendable areas so that the Germans couldn't get through. And further back until eventually they found themselves, and along with the French as well, both British and the French, were defending the perimeter around Dunkirk as the evacuation moved further back. And you had a situation where British actually did mount a counterattack on the 21st of May. So the main attack came, the attack began on the 10th of May. By the 20th of May, the Germans had reached the coast. The British then mounted this counterattack at Arras, which was surprisingly successful and actually really spooked the Germans, who really only saved the day because Rommel, you know, the legendary Rommel, this is where he kind of made his name, if you like, it took personal control and basically beat off the British attack. But it was sufficiently successful that it made the Germans very nervous that, you know, another counterattack in force could, you know, effectively cut off the panzer tanks that were to the coast. Because the tanks, if you think about it, you know, they were now in quite a bad mechanical state. They got way ahead of the infantry, way ahead of their supplies. They were coming to, you know, the area around Dunkirk, which was marshy anyway. There wouldn't be much use in Dunkirk. The Germans thought a bigger fight was still coming to the south of the Somme. They thought there was, you know, a big fight against the French was still coming. And so they stopped the tanks. Rundstedt, first of all, stopped the tanks. And then that order was confirmed by Hitler. And that confirmation had quite a lot to do with Hermann Göring basically making contact with Hitler and saying, don't let the generals win this. The generals will take credit for it, and they will be right. They will end up as rivals to you. They are not solidly Nazi. They will create trouble. Whereas if you let the Luftwaffe, we've been loyal to you from the very beginning. If you let us, we can defeat the British. So let us do it. And that was one major reason why Hitler confirmed that halting the tanks order, which lasted for 3 days and gave the British a great opportunity to be able to move more and more and more people back through the corridors and into Dunkirk.
It's fascinating to me when you mentioned that initially these British Expeditionary Forces are going abroad, and the punishment is going home. Just how quickly the tables turn.
Yeah, it's a very quick story. Actually, it is sort of remarkable. I mean, it's very slow in terms of the Boer War and the Phony War, but then suddenly everything happened. You know, people were, you know, why aren't they attacking? I mean, I think Churchill's view for a lot of this time, you know, why aren't they attacking? Do they have, you know, is something extraordinary going to happen? Is Hitler suddenly going to launch some kind of, you know, utterly terrifying, perhaps, you know, aerial attack on Britain? Or, you know, what is it going to be? And what it did turn out to be was this audacious, you know, attack through the Ardennes, which almost gave an immediate victory. And the British soldiers didn't know why they were retreating. You know, they found, I mean, I think initially a lot of them, if you talk to them, a lot of them said that they, you know, they thought maybe their own unit had done something wrong and was, you know, being sent back for some reason, or maybe there'd been an attack, you know, nearby, and they were having to fall back to create, you know, to keep a line. But you know, at first they certainly didn't know that, you know, what had happened. But I mean, the commanders didn't really know what was happening at first. It was chaos. And one thing I should probably mention is that the man who made the decision to retreat into Dunkirk and then evacuate was Lord Gore, who was the commander in chief of the British Expeditionary Force. And he's not a man who gets much credit. He wasn't a very imaginative man, really, a very brave man. But he ended up being sort of shunted off to, I think he became governor of Gibraltar after this. But he made that, I think as early as the 19th of May, you know, he was aware, you know, it was a distinct possibility that they were going to have to go all the way back to Dunkirk. And you know, by the 25th, he'd made the decision that this was going to happen. They were going to have to save as many as possible of the British Expeditionary Force through this evacuation. And this was at a point, bear in mind, when, you know, back in London, the generals back in London, certainly Churchill, was still talking about, you know, no, you must stay and you must fight and you must mount counterattacks with the French. We cannot afford to leave France. We can't afford to lose the French and all this kind of thing. And it was Gort who very bravely sort of overrode this and said, no, we go back now. And that's how, you know, spoiling anything by saying that's how the British Expeditionary Force will say. My goodness me, the war would have taken a different turn. I mean, the work today, living, would have taken a different turn. It's, you know, it's when a butterfly flaps its wings and Lord Gort made that decision.
As I'm recording this right now, on the other side of my door is my cat. He's always wherever I am as I'm working on the podcast. He watches all the movies with me, and he lets me know when it's time to stop working by sitting on my keyboard. I love the little guy. And as a pet owner, that means there are expenses like vet bills that can pop up, and sometimes that's unexpected. That's why I was happy to learn about today's sponsor, EarnIn, because they can help make sure that I've got the money to cover those unexpected vet bills. EarnIn is an app that gives you access to your pay as you work, up to $100 per day, or up to $750 per pay period. Now you can join over 3.5 million customers. Get the peace of mind that comes with EarnIn. Download EarnIn today, spelled EARNIN, in the Google Play or Apple App Store. When you download the EarnIn app, type in True Story under podcast when you sign up. It'll really help the show. True Story under podcast. EarnIn is a financial technology company, not a bank. Subject to your available earnings, daily max, pay period max, and location. See earnin.com/TOS for details. Bank products are issued by Evolve Bank and Trust, member FDIC. Thanks, EarnIn.
In the beginning of the movie, there's a character named Mr. Dawson, along with his son Peter and their friend George. And we see a couple men from the Navy who requisition Mr. Dawson's boat. It's a private yacht, and they're asked to, you know, empty everything out of the boat, load up a bunch of life jackets. We don't really hear exactly what the Navy men told them, but all we know through some dialogue is they're told that some men across the English Channel at Dunkirk need taking off. They don't seem to know a lot about what's going on either, but they're being asked. How well did the movie do showing what it was like for the citizens kind of preparing to go across the channel?
There were ordinary citizens who did take their own boats and did go across, but not many. You know, there were, for example, there was a senior surviving officer on the Titanic, from the Titanic, Michael Lightoller, you know, went across in his own boat and stuff. And, you know, I don't know if you've seen the film Mrs. Miniver, 1941 British film. There's a Dunkirk scene where a guy, just an ordinary guy, Mrs. Miniver's husband, jumps in his boat, comes back 3 days later with a beard, shattered. And that's, you know, that's a film made, I think, just a year after. So there was a story that developed, and lots of ordinary people got in boat, and a few did. But really what happened, for the most part, was that the Navy requisitioned boats. And it took them out of boatyards along the Thames or on the South Coast. People didn't know that their boats had been taken. Some did know and didn't know why their boats had been taken. One man I found who, you know, thought his boat was being stolen and chased it up to the Plymouth. And then so naval ratings ended up taking these oats across. In some cases, it would have been better if the owners had taken them across because the owners knew how they were, whereas the naval ratings often, you know, wrecked them. So, I mean, I think the reality of the story, and also fishermen, you know, a lot of fishermen did take their own boats, and non-members of the Navy took their boats, ended up signing a form that made them temporary members of the Royal Navy. It was called T124, I think. And it was a form they signed. And so for a month, I think, they were members of the, they were considered members of the Royal Navy. So people did, you know, people did sign this form. People did go across their own boat. But for the most part, it was the Navy who took these boats across. And you've got to remember that these little, known as the little ships, which started to come across in big numbers on the 30th and 31st, they were really needed for taking people off the beaches to take them to the larger ships offshore. So at the beginning, the story is amazing. You had these, you know, people were congregating in the town of Dunkirk in the cellars and the Luftwaffe were bombing. So as a result of what Goering had said, you know, because Luftwaffe really weren't, reality is that they weren't capable of doing what Goering told it that they could do. Maybe if the weather had been different and there was no cloud cover and, you know, then their tactics had been slightly different and they, you know, bombed Dover and Ramsgate and something else. You know, maybe it would have been, but the fact is they weren't, as things stood, they weren't capable of really doing it. But what they did, successfully did, was to bomb the harbor, the town and the harbor. And it put the inner harbor pretty much out of action. I mean, completely out of action, actually. And so you had this, a man called William Tennant, who was a senior naval officer ashore at Dunkirk, who had to make this, well, he had all these people, all these men, all these soldiers in Dunkirk, more were pouring in, and the harbor was out of action. So how were people going to get back to Dover, back to Ramsgate, back to Britain? And what he did, because the whole thing you got to understand was a kind of constant improvisation, you know, constantly having to make it up on the go. And what he did, what I think was the sort of the greatest improvisation of all, of anything that happened. He saw these two big sort of outer arms, the outer harbor, these two arms that went a mile out to sea, the West Mole and the East Mole. And they weren't jetties. They were basically big arms to stop the harbor silting up. And they did have wooden walkways on the top of them, but that, you know, they also had large railings alongside. It was just that people could walk out there. They weren't meant as jetties. They had huge tidal drops, I don't know, 14, 15 feet tidal drops. They had arms that, you know, no one had ever brought a ship alongside them. Tennant looked at the situation. People from the harbor, from the town would, moved onto the beaches, but at this point early on in the evacuation, there weren't any, well, sufficient little boats to bring people from the beach to the larger ships, which were starting to come. So you had large naval destroyers, naval minesweepers, you had ferries, passenger ships, but there was no way for them to come inshore and no way for the men to get out to them. So, and there weren't yet enough little ships. They, you know, all went out for them, but so what he decided to do was to use these moles, these huge breakwaters, specifically for the British, the East Mole. And he sent people, soldiers, up them, and he brought a passenger ship alongside. And on that first night of 28, you know, he got almost 1,000 people off. And he realized, this is what we've got to do. And so the majority of soldiers actually got off using those breakwaters over the course of the vast majority, over the course of the evacuation. So it's an amazing story of improvisation. And again, I mean, I think that came across pretty well in the film.
Another perspective we get from the film is in the air. And it starts with, there's three British airplains. One of the kind of the main pilot of Ferrier's, he talks about how they have 70 gallons of fuel over the radio. They're told to stay low to allow for 40 minutes of fighting time over Dunkirk, but also make sure to keep an eye on the fuel so you can have enough gas to get back. And not to skip ahead in the timeline of the movie necessarily, but there are bits of dialogue throughout where the soldiers on the beaches are just wondering where are our planes to fight off the Germans as they're coming in and bombing the beaches. So the impression that I got was from the movie that there wasn't a huge RAF presence in the air to protect the soldiers at Dunkirk, or at least not that they could see in, you know, the areas that, that we're watching in the movie. Is that a right impression to walk away from the movie with, of the RAF's role at Dunkirk?
I think you got the impression the film intended to convey, which is the accurate one, which is that the soldiers and sailors didn't think the RAF were there. You know, they were really angry. This is the way stories work. I mean, you've got the truth is that at Dunkirk, the soldiers and sailors were furious to the point that when RAF people either crash landed or for whatever reason were trying to get off at Dunkirk with the soldiers, often they weren't allowed on or they had to change their clothes to pretend they weren't RAF. People were so angry with them for not being there. If you think about it, you know, we're just talking weeks later, you've got the Battle of Britain. And they became heroes.
How quick did things turn? Wow.
But then what we've also forgotten is that after that, I mean, I found a story in Guy Gibson, who's the dam busters, in his autobiography about he was a night fighter, again, after the Battle of Britain, so during the Blitz in November of 1940. And he's in London, dressed, he's a night fighter, so flying against the bombers during the German bombers during the Blitz. And he's in London one night in his uniform. He's down in a shelter whilst the bombing is going on up above, and people start turning against him, and people are shouting at him, saying, why aren't you up there getting those, you know? And he said it was so intimidating that he would rather get out of the shelter and take his chances against the bombs, because he thought people were about to attack him down in the shelter. So this is the reality is that it's, again, it's not, you know, it's waves, people. But the point is, to get back to Dunkirk, the point is, yes, the soldiers were angry at the RAF, but the RAF also there. They were doing absolutely as much as they felt they could do and as much as they could. And the fact is that the RAF shot down more German aircraft than the Germans shot down RAF aircraft. They really were there, but there were also extremely good reasons why they weren't seen. There's quite a few reasons. I mean, so Fighter Command, for example, started employing very large formations of 2 to 4 squadrons at a time. And with the limited squadron resources available, that meant there were periods where there were gaps in the RAF's umbrella. So it added to their success rate, but it also meant that they were really, you know, the RAF really was absent for periods of time. It was there, but it was absent for periods. But then also, you have lots of, you know, first of all, they were flying high for the most part, 20,000 feet, because they wanted to be, you know, above the Germans. So that meant that they couldn't be seen. They were trying to intercept the Germans before they got to the beaches. Though a lot of the times they weren't even over the, you know, seen over the beaches. What's the point of being over the beaches once the Germans are already there? You've got the Germans had air observers behind Dunkirk so they could call aircraft up to come into the battle zone. So, you know, for that reason, sometimes the bombers did show up when the RAF weren't there. You had anti-aircraft guns from the period they were there, firing at everything. So the troops would look up and see everything being fired at, assuming everything was enemy, when in fact, you know, some of them weren't enemy. And there was cloud cover for part of the time. There were lots of reasons. I mean, they were lucky there was cloud cover because, you know, that meant that the Germans couldn't bomb and that, you know, Stukas couldn't come down and do their bombing from 1,500 feet. So there were lots and lots of very good reasons why the British couldn't see the RAF, even though they were there and doing an unbelievably important job. And bear in mind, there were very good reasons why not all of the fighter command was being used, because the British knew, Dowding knew that the bigger fight was going to come. I mean, that they were going to be needed to defend. I mean, the Battle of Britain, nobody objects to the fact that the RAF fighter command was strong during the Battle of Britain. And, the fact was they couldn't commit too much to Dunkirk because they had to reserve strength for their Battle of Britain, fight for Britain. Because the fact is that, you know, for the Germans to come across, they were going to have to win control of the air. And that battle of the fighters, the Germans coming over and the British fighters over the south of England was, you know, a fight for Britain.
I mean, you can't predict the future, but I mean, you know that what would be next, there's the big battle coming next. And so you want to make sure that you have.
They hoped there was a big battle coming next. I mean, it could have been that the British army was finished off there. If the British army had been finished off there and then, it's very hard to see any other result than Britain having to sue for peace. And then again, we're in that situation where would we be now? And the whole German ethos would have bled throughout Europe. Britain wouldn't have been there to defend, you know, liberty, freedom, the rule of law, et cetera, et cetera. Where would the second, you know, even if America joined the war, where would the second front have come from? These are all big, it's why, you know, Dunkirk is, it's interesting. Well, I was in Dunkirk quite recently, you know, and I hadn't been there since before lockdown. And I was speaking to one of the guides and he was saying that the Americans are now coming. It's part of the tour for Americans. Americans are now coming to Dunkirk. They never used to come to Dunkirk. So if this film has done anything, it's to increase awareness of the fact that Dunkirk wasn't just the little prosaic British bit that happened before America got involved. It was really unbelievably important in the whole bigger picture of the war. So, yeah, I mean, that in a way, that was the most important effect of the film to make people across the world aware that Dunkirk wasn't this little localized British fight that was passing time before America got involved. And it's also really interesting, you know, I've looked at sort of the reaction that the film has had in different countries. So, for example, I was reading that in China, it was not a popular film because it's not about a victory. And, you know, Chinese market, apparently, you know, a film about, well, at least a defeat. It's just nobody's interested in watching that. But it was so much more than that. It was, you know, this miracle of deliverance, which is not putting it too strong, that made victory possible.
There is a moment in the movie where the British soldiers are lined up along the mole trying to get onto the ship dock there. And we see some French soldiers coming on and they're turned away. One of the British soldiers flat out says, "This is a British ship. You have your own ships." And at the very end of the movie, one of the final lines is after the British are rescued, Commander Bolton mentions that he's staying behind to help the French. Can you clarify a little more, like, were the French not allowed passage on the ships or on the British ships until all the British were evacuated?
I don't think it was a rule. I think it did happen. I think the French didn't know for a long time that the British were evacuating. They realized that they were breaching. But it's probably fair to say that the Germans land before the French did. The British were evacuating. And that was one reason. And let's face it, it was a pretty valid reason why the French bore, you know, considerable grudge against the British. And also that, you know, the French did defend the perimeter. And it is true, the French were, you know, some French were not allowed onto British ships. But it's also true that as the evacuation went on, more and more French were being allowed onto British ships and were being evacuated back to Britain. And then it's also true to say that Churchill made trips across to Paris during the evacuation. And at one, he was asked how many French were being evacuated, and he had to admit it wasn't many at that point. And he said that from this point, they will go bras dessous, arm in arm from this point. And the last part of the evacuation was mostly French, Belgians, others. So somewhere between 100 and 120,000 French out of 338,000 in total were evacuated. So it's a really large number of French did come back ultimately. It's again, like so many of these things, just, you know, on the one hand, on the other hand. Yes, French people were, I think that is true. The French were prevented, and certainly in the early stages, from coming on ships. But at the same time, overall, very, very large numbers of French were evacuated back to Britain.
There's another conversation in the movie with Colonel Winnett and Commander Bolton. They're on the mole and they hear gunfire in the distance. Then Germans have broken through the dunes in the east when it says, this is it. And a few moments later, Bolton looks through his binoculars and what do you see? And Bolton replies, home. And you know, a very cinematic moment. You see a ton of the small ships arriving on the shores of Dunkirk. Heroic music swells. And then the reception is, you know, military ships are blaring their sirens. Boats are blowing their horns. The soldiers on the decks are cheering. It seems like there's this moment of, oh, you know, the rescue is here. Was there this moment of like, there's this rescue. Oh, we're going to be saved in that way?
Actually, funnily enough, even though that seems completely cinematic and unlikely, there was a moment when the convoy, the sort of armada, small ships came, you know, was first spotted en masse. And I think for a lot of people seeing that, it really was genuinely a sort of, you know, fantastic moment of, my God, we may be all right. So again, so there is some truth. You know, there were breakthroughs at different points. The Germans did break through in different spots, the perimeter, and you know, so the eastern end of the beaches, in Belgium, La Panne, De Panne, you know, that the perimeter shrunk as time went by. And so by the end, you know, by the very end of the evacuation, the Germans were very, very close. And, you know, they were shelling. I mean, you know, from outside the perimeter to inside, and the routes that the boats had to take, the ships had to take when they were coming into Dunkirk, you know, depending on where the Germans had placed their guns, you know, they were sometimes unsafe because they could be shelled from the shore. So they had to change the routes they took. So again, all this is to a degree true. And I think that, you know, the flotilla of little ships did appear and did, you know, cause a lot of people to just sort of think, well, but yeah, maybe we can get away. So again, it's not, you know, it's not fantasy. It's a film, but it's not, I mean, I doubt anyone, you know, used those precise words, home. But you know, maybe they did.
What about the timing of it? Because it seems like, oh, the Germans had broken through the dunes, and the impression I got was, oh, okay, that like they're about to attack the beaches, basically. And then you see the rescue start to happen. Was it really that close of a call there, like that?
I think they were, when the evacuation ended, you know, on the 4th of June, they were really close. So yeah, I mean, I think again, to a degree, it's not, the thing is, it is absolutely true that it was a really, really close run thing. So, you know, Churchill was hoping at the beginning of the evacuation that 30,000 people would get away. I think Ramsay, who was in Dover, in the dynamo room at Dover Castle, orchestrating the evacuation, hence Operation Dynamo, thought 45,000. You know, these, and Churchill was often a very optimistic, you know, had bouts of extreme optimism at times and pessimism. But, you know, he thought 30,000 would be a good figure. And the actual figure was, you know, 338. So it really was amazing. I mean, it truly, I mean, again, often Churchill allowed language to run away with him, but to call it a miracle of delivery is not untrue. What's a miracle? But I mean, it's not a gross exaggeration, put it that way. And, you know, if you look at that speech that Churchill made, he made on the night of the 4th, you know, fight them on the beaches, fight them on the landing ground. It's an amazing speech because there's so much honesty in it. He talks about a military disaster having taken place. He's not sugarcoating. And he's talking, you know, he's speaking on so many levels at once. He's trying to bolster the French, he's trying to bolster his own people, but he's admitting, he's saying, the Germans are coming and we're going to have to fight them on the beaches, on the landing grounds, guerrilla warfare, they're coming. And he's calling out to the Americans, calling out to the new world when all its power and might will come to the deliverance of the old. So he finishes. And he's saying to the Americans, my God, we need you. You know, please come in. But again, he's not, you know, he talks about this miracle of deliverance, but he says wars are not won by evacuations. It's a pretty honest speech. There was a lot that Churchill did try and cover up at different times, and no point going into all that. But this speech, talking to the British people and the French and the Americans and others, it's pretty blunt.
According to the movie, when I talked earlier about Mr. Dawson and his yacht that he's taking across, throughout the movie, we see him going across the channel, but he goes across, it's daytime, and then when he comes back to Britain, it's dark. And so the impression I got there was he just went across once and then came back. Was that the case? Like, they just went across once and back?
Oh, no, it absolutely depends on who you're talking about. And, you know, the big ships went again and again and again and again. The naval ships and the Sun only went once and then were bombed and destroyed. I mean, something like a third of the ships that took part in the evacuation were either sunk or put out of action. You have the little ships whose job, like I say, those small ships, their job was not to go across and bring people back. Their job was really to take people from the beaches to the larger ships ashore. So they would stay there, going backwards and forwards, backwards and forwards. And then, of course, at the end, they come back and they probably have some people on board. But, you know, their job was not specifically to take large groups of people. So it all depended. Some ships did it multiple times. So, for example, last time I was out there, I had dinner in Dunkirk. There's this floating restaurant called the Princess Elizabeth, which is one of the Dunkirk ships. It's a paddle steamer that could take, you know, several hundred soldiers at once. What it really is, it's a paddle steamer. So it's one of those, like a small version of what went up and down the Mississippi. But its job was to take tourists from the south coast, Southampton, to the Isle of Wight. And it was called into action, and it ended up doing this. And it made four trips, and in total it brought home 1,400, 1,500, 1,600 men, something like that. And then a very similar ship, although bigger, was the, I've got a picture of this somewhere. It's the other paddle steamer that's still in Dunkirk, and it's called Crested Eagle. And it was on the mole one day when the Snookers came in and came down, and it managed to get away. And it came parallel to the shore, and then it was attacked again by Snookers, which hit it this time. And the captain tried to beach it inshore, and it sunk. And 300 or so people were killed, died on board, and that's it now, if you can see it.
Let me jump in real quick here again and just mention for the audio version, if you're listening to this, you want to see the photo that Joshua has. You can see that in the video version of this chat over at youtube.com/basedonatruestorypodcast.
Still in Dunkirk. And it's almost the same. It's bigger, but it's almost the same as the Princess Elizabeth. But one is a restaurant serving food and the other one is visible at low tide. And it's the most graphic sort of comparison. And the Princess Elizabeth also, you know, this year, it's the Diamond Jubilee. Princess Elizabeth, it's called the Princess Elizabeth because it was built in 1926 when the current queen was born. So it was named after her, you know, months after her birth. And it was launched in 1927. And so they're both, you know, touch wood, still doing well. One celebrating Golden Jubilee, Diamond Jubilee, and the other one serving dinner.
Towards the end of the movie, after the men are rescued, the movie follows some of the soldiers on the train we were talking about earlier. They arrive at Woking Station, and one of the soldiers mentions how he just assumes the reaction is going to be that people are going to be spitting at them in the streets because of this. They had to retreat. It suggests that they feel like they've let their nation down. But instead, the reaction that they get is either greeted, they're handed beers, and everybody just seems happy that they're alive. What was the reaction to the returning soldiers after the rescue?
I think that's very accurate. I mean, you know, of the people I spoke to and the accounts that I came across, I mean, I think a lot of them felt that they were the sort of, I could put it, the battered remnants of a defeated army. And they came back completely expecting no welcome at all. And they found that a lot of them were treated as heroes. They were, you know, people were cheering them and slapping them on the back and giving them sandwiches as they came in and buying them drinks in pubs. And it was, I mean, I suppose what that was a kind of, you know, people often talk about Dunkirk spirit, a thing, Dunkirk spirit that's sort of come down to us. It's often slated and, you know, it's used in every sort of, you know, during Brexit on both sides, people were talking. Never mind that. Forget all that. What the instinctive Dunkirk spirit was, a kind of relief that, first of all, Uncle Bill is home. Relatives, friends are coming home. They're here. But beyond that, that the country is still fighting, that, you know, that we're not finished. And I think there was a real outpouring. If you look at the mass observation with this organization that ordinary people kept diaries and they went to different places to look at the sort of social, they're sort of anthropologists looking at Britain at the time. And it noted that there was a lot of immense relief. People, you know, suddenly buoyed by the fact that the country is still fighting. So there was this instinctive sense of relief. I think that was then taken up by the authorities who were trying to instill a sort of sense of that we're still in this. And that was, you know, so there were broadcasts on the radio and J.B. Priestley, the playwright, novelist, you know, broadcasting, you know, trying to instill this sense in people, and newspapers were doing it. But I think also, you know, the country, if you look at the sorts of other things in the literally days after Dunkirk, factory hours went up. People were putting more time in and sleeping in the factories and, you know, getting more done in the furtherance of getting the war, you know, keeping this going. You having government. They're still talking in the days, weeks after Dunkirk. They're talking about the government is actually discussing war aims, which is, you know, what are we fighting? And that's pretty amazing considering, you know, what's actually happening. And the fact is, you know, you've got these members of the government, you know, real old Lord Halifax and these fantastic old dinosaurs who are discussing, you know, what are we fighting for? And the fact that, you know, people are going to have more consideration for each other now, and that, you know, financial gain isn't the be all and end all anymore. They were genuinely talking about it. It's quite a big sort of change shift in emphasis. And so, you know, I think this, you know, like I say, Dunkirk spirit is to some degree it's imposed by the authorities, but to a great degree it was absolutely organic. And it came out of this, yeah, we're still going and we can still keep going. And what is it that we're actually fighting for? And you find that a lot of things that we take for granted in this country now, education and the National Health Service and things that came in at the end of the war or after the war, had their roots at this time when people suddenly started looking around and, well, who are we? Why are we fighting? What do we stand for as opposed to what they stand for? So I think this just little period is really important in the sort of social and cultural story of the war from a British perspective.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but the impression I get from that is they're going abroad to, you know, to see abroad, right? Even though there's war going on, and now all of a sudden they've basically been snapped into, okay, this is a war. What are we fighting for? This is serious.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I think, and of course these things, you know, in reality, these things do, you know, turn around quickly and attitudes and reactions do change very quickly. And, you know, it's all very well to talk about this, you know, this shift, this Dunkirk spirit. That doesn't mean it lasts forever. These changes in atmosphere, changes in attitudes, changes in expectations, you know, these can all happen very quickly. You know, like we were talking about the attitude to the RAF. You know, people can, you know, Dunkirk spirit, Blitz spirit, but these things change. And people who's, you know, one minute, you know, are seeing the world and their place in it in a particular way can relatively quickly stop seeing it in a completely different way. You know, we're talking about in relation to, look at the way we all look at Ukraine at the moment, and there's a sense about the States, but there's a sense in Britain that, you know, we are all looking at it in a particular way, and we're all, you know, very, very interested in Ukraine going. But there's also a realization that things can, you know, if this war goes on for a long period of time, people can, to put it bluntly and horribly, people can get bored. And people can start looking elsewhere, and people can forget, you know, how keen they were to support Ukraine at an early stage. Attitudes do change in a relatively short period of time towards things that we think are immensely important in the short term. So in the same way, you know, attitudes that were changed by Dunkirk could change back very quickly. People could, you know, by Blitz spirit, which is another thing, which is organic and was real, I believe. But it didn't necessarily last that long. You've got to be aware of this, that when you're looking at reactions and people's attitudes, they're not carved in stone. Just like the RAF was hated and loved. These things change.
Throughout the movie, some of the characters that we've talked about, Ferrier, Mr. Dawson, Tommy and Gibson on the beach, were these characters based on real people or were they amalgamations to tell the overall story?
They were amalgamations, I think it's fair to say. There were real, so, you know, the story of Light Honor, for example, was definitely something that the director was aware of. And there were so many stories, real stories, that were out there that he found or I found, you know, went into the mix. I think it's right to say they were amalgams. There was no real need to take anybody's story, you know. And in the same way, the naval officers were, you know, inspired by different people that they, you know, that were part of the real story. But there's no way that anybody was representing a particular person. So it wasn't my film, but I suspect, you know, to make anybody too close to the real person is almost a liberty. In the end, the story is a fiction based in a real theater, and to tie one character down to reality would not be fair almost.
We have talked about some of the impressions that I got while watching the movie, but I think everyone walking away from a movie gets different impressions from the story that was told. So what's something that you want to make sure that someone watching this movie walks away with?
Well, I suppose I've already said it, really, that what I'd like anybody who sees the movie to be at least aware that there's no one story, and there never is. You know, the world, life doesn't work that way. It just doesn't. There's so many interesting dramas nowadays that focus on, I just say this, I've just been watching it. There's an American series called This Is Us. It takes a family and looks at them over a period of years and goes backwards and forwards, and it plays with time and it plays with, Christopher Nolan famously plays with time. But it looks at the same event from different people's perspective, and you realize it does it well because you realize we don't see things different. We don't see things the same. We all interpret everything differently, and the real story is different. If depending on when, what time and where you're at the beach, you know, you're going to have a different perspective. I'd want you to come away with that. It's a broad, it's not just about Dunkirk. It's about everything you've ever done. One thing that I was I think this might be worth, I find this quite interesting. Your viewers can decide if they agree, but one thing that when I was in Dunkirk, I always find that, so being somewhere can really inform you about an event that took place up there, however many years before it was. So I found this story which fascinated me, which was that there was a naval signals commander called, I think his name's Emerson, who wrote, I found all this in the British National Archives, that a Marconi transmitter had been brought to Dunkirk, because one of the big problems that this guy Tennant I was talking about had was communicating with ships offshore, communicating with Ramsay back in Dover, just basically communicating, because obviously none of this had been planned in advance. Communications had been set up. And while there was an undersea link between Pan and Dover, there wasn't anything where he was, which is actually in Dunkirk. So for part of the time, he was using the French transmitter, which is back French headquarters. Part of the time he was going to ships that were on the mole and using their transmitters to talk to Dover or to other ships. None of this was ideal. So he had a Marconi transmitter brought over, and it was brought in to beat. And I read this account and it said it was brought over, and then it was in use for a few hours, and then it broke, it stopped working because it got sand in the generator. So fascinating. Because I thought, you know, they've gone to the effort to bring this huge, great, state-of-the-art Marconi transmitter, and it gets sand. You know, it's only in use for a few hours because it gets all sanded up. And I was sort of thinking, well, how are they so complacent to let, you know? And I had almost this picture of, you know, a couple of naval ratings sort of moving it and dropping it in the sand to not admit it. I don't know. And it's like Laurel and Hardy. I couldn't. And then when I was there for a period, long period of time, and you realize that when the wind really gets up, even in summer, and when the wind gets up, it becomes like a sort of desert sandstorm, where, not quite like a desert sandstorm, but it becomes pretty fierce. And so everyone was sort of walking around with goggles and with, you know, pre-COVID masks around them and things wrapped around their faces. And it was really, really difficult to function. And it occurred to me that was probably what happened. Probably the wind blew and it just silted up the thing, and it then couldn't be used. And that's what I mean by sometimes you have to be at a place to really, you know, the location actually informs the history. And I found that very moving. Actually, that to be there at the same time of year, and the weather wasn't particularly bad, but there were periods when it just got so windy that it became almost unbearable. It just whipped up, and I think the lesson there, if there is one, is sometimes you have to go to a place to really begin to understand what might have happened back in the day.
No, that makes sense. That the location is also a character in history, for sure. Since you got to work on the movie, what's your favorite story from your time on the production?
My favorite story. One is that there was a screening before the film was actually out there, released. There was a screening for veterans that was done in London at a small cinema. And my God, that was moving. I mean, all of these, and you know, there really aren't any left. I mean, there may be some, but none that I know. And I don't know how many, 20, 25 of the veterans with their families came and sat there watching this attempt to recreate, demonstrate their experience. And the director, Christopher Nolan, was so much more nervous about how they reacted to the film than how any critic or anybody else. He wanted it to be acceptable to them. And I found that very moving. And the fact that, you know, these people who had been there a lifetime, they were kids, actually, when they were there. And here they were now with, you know, their great grandchildren, some of whom were now in the military. There was one man who's had a great grandchild who's in uniform, and you just, my God, it's almost too much to get your head around. And there they were sitting in the audience watching it, and that was very moving. Which was another thing that I remember is the day that the director first showed up at my house and at my flat. I got in the flat in London, and he showed up and we chatted. And he showed me the script, and he left the script with me overnight, which is, I later realized, is not something he tends to do. He's quite secretive over his scripts. It all happened quite quick. It came as a, you know, it was sort of a not something I was expecting. And so it was, and you know, you do what I do to write books, and you do. It's an interesting life. It's not that particularly, you don't know what's coming next. Could be good, could be bad. It's always interesting. And this was a particularly interesting little, you know, period of my working life. So yeah, I'm very grateful to have done.
Well, thank you so much for coming on to chat about Dunkirk. Speaking of books, not only were the historical consultant on the movie. You also wrote the book adaptation called Dunkirk, The History Behind the Major Motion Picture. So for someone listening to this who wants to learn more, maybe can you give us one of your favorite stories from the real history that didn't make its way into the movie from the book, that and where they can pick up a copy of it?
Oh, gosh, a real story. It's just,
the tough questions at the end, sorry.
I can't remember. Oh, God, there are so many just, you know, fantastic stories of, you know, all the way through running from the, well, I mean, sort of running from the, you know, the political, the fact that there were people in cabinet who wanted to make peace. They wanted to approach Hitler through the Italian ambassador, because he was not yet in the war, and how different things would have turned out if that approach had been taken. To, you know, God knows how many personal, you know, unbelievably personal stories of yeah, okay, here's one. This to me is sort of sums up how strange it was. You had these passenger ships that were coming alongside the Mole, these large, you know, I've talked about the Crested Eagle and others, but even bigger than that, you know, these really big ferries really that were coming to pick people up. And this one, and they're full of, you know, people working on board who, when they were ferries, were working on board. And so one man talks about the fact, an officer talks about the fact that they were in terrible state. They'd got up the Mole, they walked over dead bodies to get on board the ship, they clambered on. This man said he collapsed in the corner, just a quiet corner, and just, you know, passed out. And he said he was woken up almost immediately by a man in a white coat who came up to him and said, could I get you anything? And he looked up and he said, are you a steward? And the man said, yes, sir, I am. So this was a passenger ship with its stuff. This was a waiter come up to him. He asked him if he wanted it. And he said he just couldn't believe it after the hell he just experienced. Here was a waiter. And he said, well, I don't suppose that get me a glass of beer. And the man said, well, I would, sir, but I'm sure you know the rules. I'm not allowed to serve alcohol until we're 3 miles offshore. And he said, at that moment, I thought, with people like this, how can we lose the war? I mean, you know, it was a moment for him where he stepped out of the hell of Dunkirk and onto this ship where a man said, well, I'd love to get you a beer, sir, but I can't do that until we've moved offshore. And he said, it kind of sums up the weirdness of the whole event, that the improvised nature of it, the fact that, you know, everyone was called in to help. And even the waiter who absolutely will stick to the rules and love to get you a beer, but can't get it.
I mean, that's even similar to what we've been talking, the contrasts, you know, this from beginning to end. Well, thank you again so much for your time. I really appreciate it. Learned a lot.
I'm glad. Yeah, no, I mean, it's nice. It's great talking about it. I mean, I was, you know, like I said, I was in Dunkirk a week ago. It's the first time I've been back for ages. And it was wonderful to go back and to, you know, have all the memories sort of the film and of the veterans and, you know, the whole story sort of stirred up again in me. And I strongly recommend, you know, if people want to go and visit, it's a very, very emotive place to visit. So I strongly recommend it.
This episode of Based on a True Story was produced by me, Dan Lefebvre. I'd like to thank Joshua Levine once again for sharing his expertise about the history behind Dunkirk. If you want to hear more about the true story, I would highly recommend picking up a copy of Joshua's book called Dunkirk, The History Behind the Major Motion Picture. As always, you can find links to that book in the show notes for this episode, as well as on the show's home on the web, basedonatruestorypodcast.com. Okay, now it's time for the answer to our two truths and lie game from the beginning of the episode. And as a refresher, here are the two truths and one lie. Number one. The senior most surviving officer from the Titanic helped in the Dunkirk evacuation. Number two, Churchill didn't expect to evacuate anyone from Dunkirk. Number three, people not in the Navy who took their boats signed a form to become temporary members of the Royal Navy. Did you find out which one is a lie? Let's go backwards and we'll start with number three. People not in the Navy who took their boats signed a form to become temporary members of the Royal Navy. That is true. As Joshua explained, non-members of the Navy who took their boats across ended up signing a form that made them temporary members of the Royal Navy. That brings us to number two. Churchill didn't expect to evacuate anyone from Dunkirk. That's the lie. We learned that Churchill was hopeful to rescue about 30,000 from Dunkirk, but when all was said and done, over 338,000 people were rescued. That means number one is also true. The senior most surviving officer from the Titanic helped in the Dunkirk evacuation. As we learned, Charles Lightoller was the senior most member of the crew to survive the Titanic disaster. That was in 1912. Then in 1940, he used his own ship to help with the Dunkirk evacuation. Last but not least, it's time now to let you know how long it took to create this episode. If you're a longtime listener to the podcast, you'll know that I like to share this information just to help you appreciate all the podcasts you listen to. After all, a huge majority of podcasts are like mine, completely free to listen to, but that doesn't mean that they're free to create. Quite the opposite. Even though podcasts don't always cost a lot of money, they almost always cost a lot of time. The time it takes to learn the technical side to begin with, the research to create them on an ongoing basis, to record them, to edit them, and so on. But I only have the stats for my own show. So with that in mind, today's episode took me 41 hours to create. And to make it clear, that's only my time. It doesn't include any of Joshua's time. And to be even more specific, it isn't even all of my time, because that 41 hours is only the time it took for me to produce this one episode. It doesn't include all the time I spend building, maintaining the Based on a True Story website, finding new guests, scheduling, logistics, social media, and so on. All those things don't really have anything to do with making today's episode specifically, but they're still required overall to make the podcast. In a nutshell, this podcast may be free to listen to, but it is not free to create. And that's why I'm so thankful for the sponsors whose ads you've heard on this episode. You can find out more information about them over at basedonatruestorypodcast.com/advertisers. But they're not the only ones helping to keep the show alive. There are wonderful people just like you who are helping to keep this show financially going. So if you enjoyed today's episode, I hope you'll consider supporting the next episode over at basedonatruestorypodcast.com/support. Once again, that's basedonatruestorypodcast.com/support. And don't forget, if you want to chat about this episode, you can do that over in the Based on a True Story Facebook group. Until next time, thanks so much for listening, and I'll chat with you again really soon.